Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. Thanks for listening. Here's my number, 888-914-915. Huh. Whoa, let me start over.
Hey, what was that?
I know. 888-914-9149. I had to slow it down. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you know that the people on TikTok, many of them anyway, at least the ones that that we see on the libs of TikTok, we know that they can be pretty stupid, right?
Stupid is what stupid does, sir.
Yes. How stupid could these people possibly be?
Oh, be careful what you ask, Patrick. They one up each other because it gets views.
I know. Well, I have right here. And this is from Vice.com. This is a new low of stupidity. You ready?
I hope so.
Some of these TikTokers are starting forest fires for views. They're starting fires. They're lighting stuff on fire and then trying to do a video in front of the raging inferno.
Whoa, what's going to happen if they can't take their phones into prison with them? They're going to go through withdrawals.
That'll be a tough one for them, right? Humaira Askar, known as Dolly to her 11.5 million TikTok fans, faces charges for allegedly setting a forest fire while shooting a TikTok video. And this is over in Pakistan. I mean, this is everywhere. It's not just here in the U.S. In the 11-second clip that has since been taken down, she dramatically walks down a forested hill covered in flames in slow motion with a trending pop song that mentions setting fire playing in the background. Dum, 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 dum. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. The caption posted with the video, which was filmed in a national park, by the way, reads, "Fire erupts wherever I am." Stupid erupts wherever I am.
Wherever I go.
Wherever stupid is, wow. I will be there. She's not the only TikToker who's been accused of setting a forest fire for views. You may say that's just a one-time. No, other people are doing this. Apparently, it's a trend, especially in Pakistan. Why there, I don't know, but they're suffering from a record-breaking heat wave. Islamabad Wildlife Management Board Chairperson Reena S. Khansati said, "Young people desperate for followers are setting fire to our forest during this hot and dry season. These psychotic young people have to be caught and put behind bars immediately." Now, it goes through and it not only catalogs, you know, the different plant species and bird varieties and animals and reptiles that are getting wiped out because they're setting fire to these forests so that they can do a nice video. But they also talk about how this trend is kind of a, you know, it's a copycat kind of thing. So somebody sees that on TikTok and they say, oh, that would be kind of fun. And they go light something on fire.
Well, because so, these people don't have an original thought. They'd be like, oh, that looked cool. I'm gonna burn something. Yeah. And, you know, whatever, who cares about the consequence? What consequences? It's,
well, if you're in Pakistan, they're on to you now. So let's just hope that particular brand of stupid does not spread. But you can see all kinds of it on the libs of TikTok. I really do suggest, parents, if you want to see what your kids are at least in danger of seeing on TikTok, watch that. Go to that website or look at it on the Twitter feed, libs of TikTok. Let's go to David in Tampa. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
My question is regarding the first book in the Bible, Genesis.
Okay.
Chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. It says that God created humans in his own image. And then later on, shortly thereafter, Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, he created Adam from dust. And I'm trying to reconcile the two there.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's a very astute question.
Does that mean there were humans before Adam? Or
no. Okay, so we could start there. So Adam and Eve are our first parents, so they are the first human beings. It doesn't mean that there were not hominids of some sort, perhaps, before Adam and Eve, but God directly created Adam and Eve as human beings with immortal souls, etc. So the way to harmonize these two passages is to see that they're talking about two different things. In the case of Genesis 2:7, God made Adam out of the primordial earth, Mother Earth, so to speak. Now, how exactly he did that is not revealed to us because Genesis is not intended to be a scientific or historical account of what happened. It's a statement of truth, but it doesn't go into the details about how exactly this happened. So one way of interpreting it would be maybe the more traditional way, which would be to imagine God, you know, God doesn't have a body, but imagine God scooping up, you know, a handful of clay and then fashioning the body. My sense of it is that it probably didn't happen like that. But in any case, what Genesis says is true. Adam and Eve are our very first parents, and God made them directly as human beings. In Genesis 1, 26 and 27, where it talks about making God in his own image. So let me just read the two verses. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So there where it talks about image and likeness, image does not refer to like head and hands and feet because God does not have a body. God is a pure spirit. Rather, this refers to being made in his image insofar as God has an intellect and a will. Or you might say he is an intellect and a will. He knows the truth. He knows all things. So we are made in God's image in that we are made with an intellect and a will. We are like him in that regard. So we can see, in a sense, a reflection of God in human beings. With our intellects, we know what is true, and with our will, we are to choose what is good. Now, likeness is, it's not a redundancy. It's not like kith and kin, you know, or warp and woof. When you use a term to make an emphasis, sometimes we'll say it with a degree of repetition. This is not repetition. The likeness spoken of here is God's holiness. So we are made in God's image in that we have an intellect and a will, and we are made in God's likeness in that we are holy. So the more holy someone is, the more like God that person is. So Adam and Eve were sinless before the fall. So they had a likeness unto God's. And so when we talk about image and likeness, we're talking about those two separate things. And so that's why this does not conflict with what we read in Genesis 2, because they're talking about two separate aspects of the creation of human beings. How does that sound, David?
So we don't really know, or what, in chapter 1, 26, 27, these people may not even have looked like Adam and Eve, or do we, does that make
which people?
Sense, or am I?
I'm not sure what the question is. Could you refine that for me?
In chapter 1, verse 26, where created humans in his own image, does what you're saying, we don't know what they look like, or...
Oh, okay. If you mean like what color were their eyes, or what color was their skin, or what color was their hair, or how tall, if that's what you're referring to... Yeah, so if that's what you mean, sure, we don't know. We don't know what color their eyes or hair or skin color was. We can guess at it, but we don't know. Nobody knows. But the likeness or image and likeness does not have anything to do with bodily features. It has to do with intellect and will and with holiness. Because God, as I say, God does not have a body. So it's not as though they were made to look like little gods. Their bodies are human. Their bodies and their bodily features have nothing to do with the image or the likeness of God.
Okay. So they're really not like Adam and Eve, these humans in chapter 1, verse 26.
See, that's where I'm having trouble understanding the question, because the they that you're referring to, they are Adam and Eve. So those two people spoken of there in Genesis the 3. Go ahead, David.
Verse 26 and 27. We don't have to assume that they're like Adam and Eve, even though they're humankind.
Well, let me put it this way. In verses 26 and 27, it's talking about Adam and Eve. It's referring to them. So he says, let us make them, let them have dominion over the fish. Now, obviously, by extension, that applies to all of humanity that comes after Adam and Eve. But in the creation of these two human beings, Adam and Eve, what you see in Genesis 1:26 and Genesis 1:27 and Genesis 1:28 and following, those passages are speaking specifically about Adam and Eve.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Now I think I get it now.
Okay. Cool. These are good questions. Right. I'm glad you're asking them. You might enjoy a book by the former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. He became Pope Benedict XVI. He wrote a little book called In the Beginning, which is a theological and biblical reflection on the creation of Adam and Eve and the creation of the cosmos, for that matter. I found that very insightful. I think you might enjoy it.
Well, I've read the Bible totally two or three times, Genesis a few times, and each time I read it, I guess I read it too quick. I always pick up something I didn't get before, and there's always another question.
And isn't that great? It's inexhaustible, isn't it?
Yeah.
So for what it's worth, David, I read the Bible too, and I mean, that's the best thing to read above all other things. But this book that I mentioned by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, it's a commentary on the Bible. In other words, it's a commentary on Genesis 1, 2, and 3. So it might be interesting for that reason, because he's got some really keen insights, I think. So check it out. And thanks for the call. I appreciate that. How about Laura now in Houston, Texas? Good morning, Laura. I understand that the heat in Texas is getting pretty out of control these days. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It's just the humidity that makes it worse, but it's good for our skin. good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going back to, I can't remember if it was this week or last week, the argument of those for abortion, the consequential response that, okay, well, she got raped, so it was okay to have an abortion, or she's too young, she can't afford it, so it's okay to have an abortion. Like that reason and logic. And I like the other caller saying that we really need to pray for people, for God to soften their hearts, because they really want to make that like the reason that then it's okay to have an abortion, like, or how would you know, or, you know, the struggle that the child is going to go through. How, I believe you had an answer for that, how to respond, because I completely get of the logic incoherent of, you know, well, it's not okay to kill innocent people, human beings, right. But this wave of like, no, the because of this, you know, that's why it's okay to have an abortion. Right.
Yes. Well, you mentioned consequentialism, so maybe we should start there. Pope John Paul II wrote an encyclical back in 1992 or 93, called Veritatis Splendor, the splendor of the truth. And he's extolling the importance, not only the importance of truth, but the importance of knowing the truth and not being subjected to fallacies and errors. We need to know the truth. And among the errors and fallacies that he critiques, and in my view, very, very successfully dismantles, is consequentialism. Now, consequentialism is just one of the mistakes that some people make when approaching a topic, a moral topic, let's say like abortion. But the essence of this error is to say that in a given situation, that an otherwise immoral act could be moral because of the consequences that would follow. So according to this illogic, if it may well be that this unborn child might grow up poor, let's kill it now because we don't want the consequence of poverty in the future. That would be really mean to allow somebody to be poor. So you can see the error is, obviously, you don't kill the person because he might grow up poor, or he might join a gang, or he might go to prison, or he might kill somebody. These are all what ifs that could apply to anybody. It could apply to all of us, including all of us who are alive right now. So those what ifs are always going to be part of the human experience in this life. And so what John Paul does in Veritatis Splendor is he points out how this fails utterly as a criterion to determine whether or not something is moral or immoral. And he goes into much greater detail, but that's his critique of consequentialism. And I think Catholics would do well to read that document, even just for that one part of it.
What is it called again? I'm sorry, from John Paul?
Yes, so Veritatis, so V-E-R-I-T-A-T-I-S, and then splendor is the second word. And in Latin, it's reverse order, but what it means is splendor of the truth, or the splendor of the truth.
And because we had a conversation within our group of, like, the third world countries, you know, they're not being preventative measures. Well, you don't want the child to suffer. And there's so many kids in, you know, India or Mexico or any kind of third world country. And it's like, it's true, but in arguing here in the States where there's so many resources, so many groups to help, you know, not just the kid, the individual, but I guess their argument was, well, the third world countries.
Yes. Well, fair enough. But what I would say in response to people who try to argue that way is, number one, you can't know what the outcome is going to be. You can only guess. And even if there's a high degree of probability, it doesn't mean that it's going to happen, you know, whatever dire prediction you might make. This person just as easily might be the one who cures cancer. You know, he could be poor, he could turn to drugs, he could go to jail. He could also be a physician or a scientist, and he might find the cure for cancer. So you'll notice that the application of the error of consequentialism always goes to the negative. It never goes toward the potential possible good that could be done. But
yeah,
you can
all good of a person not being able to bear children, and well, there you go. They went to adoption, and now they're blessed with a child because they adopted, at child.
Yes. Yes, you're right. So the point that John Paul II was making there is that, to repeat myself, but I think it's important to repeat it, is that the error, the fallacy of consequentialism, proportionalism is another kind of way of talking about it, that it fails. It's not an adequate criterion to determine whether or not a given act is morally permissible or immoral. So that's where a lot of people founder, is because they try to apply this logic and say, well, this unborn child's probably going to be poor, or probably going to be on drugs, or probably going to be in jail. Therefore, let's kill it now. I mean, it's self-evident why it's a bad way of trying to evaluate this, but a lot of people fall into this error. So.
Okay. Thank you so much. Have a great
You're
rest
welcome.
Of the day. God bless
you. You're welcome. Thanks, Laura. Veritatis Splendor. Read it, know it, love it, learn it. It will help you, trust me. It will help you in your conversations with people who are addled with error, and they just don't get it. They just have a hard time understanding why you should not kill innocent human beings. This is what Pope John Paul II did so well. I mean, he was razor sharp, razor sharp. He was an exacto knife intellectually when it came to explaining the truth. And that's what this encyclical does. So you're not going to be able to sit down and read it in 15 minutes, that's for sure. But put it on your nightstand and read a little bit of it every night. It'll do you good. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show and your phone calls right after this. My number is 888-914-9149. I'm waiting for your call. 888-914-9149. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right, moving and grooving here on the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. Frank in St. Louis, welcome to the program, sir.
How are you, Patrick?
I am well, sir. Thank you.
Good. The question, I heard this Baptist minister say that the Catholics were teaching false doctrine by saying that Jesus was the firstborn, not meaning there was no more children after.
Right. Was there more to the question, or is that the question?
No, that's the question, you know.
Okay. Yeah, so Mary is a perpetual virgin. So first, let's start there. She was a virgin before, during, and after the birth of Jesus, which means that Jesus did not have any siblings born from the Blessed Virgin Mary. He certainly did have close relatives. In fact, we do see them mentioned, in some cases mentioned by name. So we are told in Matthew 13, for example, about four men, James, Joseph, Simon, and Jude. And we read, it says, is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Jude? That is Jude Thaddeus, by the way, not Judas Iscariot. So we see passages like that in which people are even named as the brothers of the Lord. But it doesn't mean that Mary had other children besides Jesus. Usually when people like the Baptist minister say that because he was the firstborn, they're usually referring to Matthew's gospel, where it refers to, and this is in chapter 1, where it refers to Joseph and Mary, and it says that he did not know her, and that's a biblical euphemism for sexual intercourse. He did not know her until she brought forth her firstborn son. Usually that's the kind of the passage that is the most often quoted in this regard. And the presumption is that, well, if he didn't know her before she brought forth her firstborn son, then it suggests that he did know her after she brought forth her firstborn son. And that's where the mistake is made. And the way to point that out is that the terminology that's used here as, you know, until, does not necessitate that something happened after that point, but simply that something didn't happen up to that point. So if I said, Grandma didn't take her medicine until she died, well, it doesn't mean she took her medicine after she died, obviously. She just didn't take it before she died. And there are many examples of this in Scripture, but the main thing to understand is that Mary, she, in her reaction to the angel Gabriel's message in Luke chapter 1, it doesn't make any sense, really, because she says, the angel says to her, Mary, you're going to conceive and have a baby. And her reaction is one of puzzlement. It's not that she doubts, she just doesn't understand it. And she says, how can this be? For I do not know man. And that's another biblical euphemism for sexual intercourse. Now, she was already married. She was in the betrothal stage of the marriage. And she was soon about to enter into married life fully with St. Joseph and live under the same roof with him. So her response in Luke 1 indicates, although it doesn't say this explicitly, it you might say we can infer this from her reaction, and that is that she took a vow of perpetual virginity. And the church fathers who comment on this say that she had taken a vow of perpetual virginity. So that would explain then her reaction. How is this going to be? Because after all, Our Lady knew how babies come into this world. She had sisters and cousins and friends, and she knew where babies come from, and she knew that when other women got married, within 9 months, 10 months, or a year, they would have babies. So she knew all about that. And so it would be odd for her to react the way she did if, as she was on the eve fully marrying or finally living with St. Joseph, if she had not intended to have other children, her reaction doesn't make any sense. It'd be like, well, yeah, of course I'm going to have a baby. I hope I have a lot of babies. I'm married now, and I'll be soon living with my husband. And I know where babies come from. But her reaction is not that. Her reaction is, how is this going to happen? So that's the first thing to keep in mind. The second thing to remember is that in the case of, you know, the until phrases, like the one I mentioned a minute ago in Matthew chapter 1, verse 25, he had no relations with her until she bore a son, and he named him Jesus. We see this in the underlying Greek, for example. Haos is one form of it, or haos hu, which is just a longer form. They both mean the same thing. They're identical. It just means until. We see many examples of this. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 25, we're told that Christ will reign until he puts all things under his feet. Well, it doesn't mean that after he puts all things under his feet that he will no longer reign. It just means that he will reign as the King of Kings until this time. It doesn't suggest that something will change afterward. Now, there are many other examples of this. John chapter 4, verse 49, Romans chapter 8, verse 22. Revelation chapter 2, verses 25 and 26, Ephesians chapter 4, verse 13, 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 13, and chapter 6, verse 14, or 19, rather. These are all examples of where you can see this construction about something being one way or the other until, but not necessitating a change after. And then I'll leave you with one final one. This is in 2 Samuel chapter 6. It's in verse 23. It's a very interesting story, and it's actually kind of funny. It's a sad story, but it's funny in a certain way, because when the Ark of the Covenant was recaptured from the Philistines after it had been lost in battle, we're told that the Ark was triumphantly borne back into the city of David on the shoulders of the soldiers. And King David leaped for joy before the ark of the Lord. He danced, we're told, with great abandon. And that's a way of saying, how can I put this? He let it all hang out. Maybe that'd be a good way to put it. Imagine King David wearing a kilt, if you follow my meaning. So his wife, Michal, the daughter of Saul, she's observing her husband, letting it all hang out because he's so happy. He's dancing, he's leaping around. And let's just say he was not practicing modesty. And so she gets angry with him. And that passage ends with the statement that after that, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children until the day of her death. Now, obviously, that means that what is necessary for a baby to be conceived did not take place between David and Michal because she was ticked off. Sounds like she really held a grudge. It doesn't mean that she had a baby after she died, obviously. It just means she didn't have a baby until that time. So suffice to say, the Bible does not say in any explicit way that Mary had no other children besides Jesus. All the evidence is implicit. Nor does the Bible say that Mary had other children after Jesus. The Bible is, in any explicit sense, it is silent on that issue. But the implicit evidence points us to Mary's perpetual virginity. So we see, for example, going back to Matthew chapter 13, James, Joseph, Simon, and Jude. They're called the brothers of the Lord. That would seem to cinch the case, but it doesn't, because we know that two of these four men, James and Joseph, they were actually the sons of Mary, but not Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary, the wife of Cleophas, also known as Clopas or Alpheus. So she, that Mary, was perhaps a close relative of the Blessed Virgin Mary, maybe her sister, maybe a cousin, some other close relative. And for sure, we know that that Mary was present because we see her in John chapter 19 at the foot of the cross. So there's Mary Magdalene, the Blessed Virgin Mary, St. John, and this Mary, the mother of two of those men who are called the brothers of the Lord. So the custom of calling your close relatives, cousins, nephews, uncles, etc., calling them brother, that was standard. In fact, in my visits to the Holy Land, and I've asked some people, Palestinians and Israelis and others, and they say, yeah, that's still a very common thing culturally and even in these languages. So that's what you're seeing there. You're not seeing any evidence that Mary had other children besides Jesus. Last thing, these arguments are as old as the hills. And there was a guy during the time of St. Jerome. St. Jerome was a contemporary of St. Augustine. St. Augustine was born in the year 354, he was born. He died in the year 430. And St. Jerome was a contemporary of his. So we're talking 4th century and into the 5th century. Well, there was a dude named Helvidius, and he wrote a tract about Mary having other children. And he used the same arguments. He used Matthew chapter 1, the passage that I just quoted, verse 25, and others. And St. Jerome, when he heard about this, he wrote a response, and it's out there. You can read it online in English. It's called Against Helvidius. And he just did a Mexican hat dance on this guy. He just destroyed his arguments, and he went through every single one of them, and he showed that Our Lady, biblically speaking, is not said to have had other children besides Jesus. So he was defending against this kind of error way back then. And he was perhaps the greatest Bible translator the church has ever seen. He was a profound biblical theologian, but he was a master of the languages. So he knew Greek, he knew Hebrew, he knew Latin, and he was an expert on these issues. And he showed that Helvidius was wrong. Last little thing, I can't help myself, but I've got to mention this too. Martin Luther and even John Calvin both defended the perpetual virginity of Mary. They were no friends of the Catholic Church, that's for sure, and they tore into the Catholic Church any chance they got. But on this issue, they got it right, and they dismissed arguments like this Baptist minister is using, saying that Mary had other children besides Jesus. They dismissed that as an error, which it is, and they too rejected this notion. So that should say something for people who latch on to these notions that Mary had other children besides Jesus. Even Luther and Calvin, they rejected those. I'll have to leave it at that. But I hope that's helpful to you, Frank. And there's plenty more where that came from. Call me again. Let's go to Scott now in Woodbury, Minnesota. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Patrick. My question is the plenary indulgence that was in effect for the pandemic, is that still in effect?
I don't know, you know, offhand if there was any duration that was associated with it. So if the Pope or if a bishop who granted an indulgence said for this period of time or until such and such, I just don't know if that's the case. You'd have to look it up, I suppose, and read what the requirements were. But if it was something that was intended for that period of time, I think it would be no longer in force.
Okay. I was just referring to the one where, you know, you could listen to electronic media for, you know, the rosary or the mass, and you could get an indulgence. I thought the Pope issued that, so.
Yeah, I think he did. And once the Sunday obligation was back in effect or reinstated, I don't know how a canon lawyer would put it, but for the rest of us, let's say once that was reinstated, I don't know whether or not that was the conclusion of the plenary indulgence associated with watching the mass on television. I just don't know. But I'll bet you if you did a little Googling, you could probably find out as quickly as I could.
I found something.
Did you?
Yeah, it's an original report about when the indulgence took effect, and it says somewhere about halfway down. Sorry, I'm kind of reading this on the fly.
That's fine.
The cases of grave necessity in by Canon Law 961 apply today, especially in places that are most affected by the pandemic. And this will last. Thanks, Patrick. I love that. You and my wife love to correct me. All right. And it'll last. This is the important part. It'll last until the COVID-19 phenomenon has ended.
Well, there you go, Scott. Cyrus, do you want
appreciate
to?
It.
Yeah. Maybe Cyrus can get a link posted that for you.
I will. I'll try to find some alternate sources, too, just to make sure that, you know, what I'm saying is correct.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question, I guess, for the Apostle Creed. You know, it says Jesus Christ was crucified, died, and was buried, mm-hmm. and then descended into hell. I've read or heard someone say that, you know, those destined for heaven do not go to hell. They may spend time in purgatory, but not hell.
Right.
So how is it that Jesus Christ went to hell?
Well, he didn't go to hell of the damned, if that's probably what you're thinking. He went to the underworld. And so he went to the place where all the righteous of the Old Testament era were waiting, those who are going to go to heaven but couldn't because the gates of heaven had been closed by Adam and Eve's original sin. So that's where he went. That's what he said to the good thief when he said, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. So he went to that place that he describes for us in Luke chapter 16, where he talks about Lazarus and the rich man. Remember that story. And Lazarus goes to a place of tranquility, also known as the limbo of the fathers or even paradise. So they were all in the underworld. The rich man was in a place of punishment. And when the rich man has this conversation with Abraham, Abraham says, there is a great gulf or chasm between where you are and where we are. We can't cross to you and you can't cross to us. So they were separated, but they were all in Sheol or Hades in the Greek. So in our English translation of the Creed, it uses the word hell because it's a translation from the, in this case, from the Latin. But the Latin does not have the connotation solely of the hell of the damned. In English, it does. So that's one of these artifacts of languages, is that they mean different things to different people. But for our purposes here, we can just say that when Jesus, when it said that he descended into hell, he went to the underworld. And that was known as they say, Sheol or Hades, hell in an archaic way. Now, some Bible verses that touch upon this briefly, Mike. The first one would be in 1 Peter chapter 3, where it says in verse 18, "For Christ also suffered for sins once, the righteous for the sake of the unrighteous, that he might lead you to God. Put to death in the flesh, he was brought to life in the spirit. In it, he also went to preach to the spirits in prison, who had once been disobedient while God patiently waited in the days of Noah." So he continues on from there. But the spirits in prison are those people. They were waiting. And then in verse 6, it says it again, and this is in chapter 4, verse 6 of 1 Peter. "For this is why the gospel was preached even to the dead, that though condemned in the flesh in human estimation, they might live in the spirit in the estimation of God." That's an oblique reference to those who are there waiting. So that's the answer.
Very good. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you. And this is a perfect time for us to step aside and take a break and return lickety-split to your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'm here for you, waiting for your phone call. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
I'm just reading this article that somebody sent me on Twitter. My thanks to that person. It's from a publication in Seville, Spain. It's in Spanish, but I'll just translate it for you. I love this kind of stuff. So Bishop Jesus Catalá, he is giving an interview, and he's talking about the abortion laws in Spain. And he just nails it, because he says, well, you know, by the way, it is illegal to destroy an eagle's egg in Spain. So if you come across an eagle's nest and you destroy that egg, you'll go to jail. So the point, obviously, is if it's illegal to destroy an eagle's egg, why is it not illegal to destroy an unborn human being? So my thanks to the person who sent me that on Twitter. Cool stuff. Let's go to Mike now in Turlock, California. Hello, Mike.
Mr. Madrid, how you doing?
I am well, thank you.
Good. Hey, my question was, I think you were talking about a guy named Wally Pope or Tope earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My question was, in Matthew chapter 7, verse 6, can you explain, first of all, what that is? And then does that apply to what he did?
Okay, yeah. So I just opened to that passage. So Matthew 7, 6, this is Jesus speaking, says, "Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before swine, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you." Okay. Does this apply to what Wally Tope did? Now, some people listening right now did not hear what I was saying earlier in the program about during the L.A. riots in 1992 and people just getting killed in the streets and buildings being torched and just a melee. It was terrible. And a Protestant preacher, missionary type guy. He went right into the middle of all this with some Bible tracts, and they bashed his head in and killed him because they were not interested in Bible tracts. And so I used him as a sad example of somebody who did not exercise prudence. Now, he would say, well, I went right to the heart of the problem because there were people there who were doing bad things. I was trying to witness to them and get them to stop doing this. And I agree with that. But he took the wrong approach, and he did it in the wrong way. So I believe it was imprudent for him to do what he did. And he died as a result of that. So was he, in fact, casting pearls before swine? Was he giving something holy to dogs? Now, Jesus is using these figures of speech. It's not that he regards people as dogs. It's something like, if people are not going to appreciate or value something of great importance and beauty, don't waste it on them. So I had never thought of this passage before, and I'm not absolutely sure that it would directly apply to him, but I could see why you might look at that and be reminded of his situation, because he got trampled underfoot. They did turn to attack him. He was trying to do something helpful for them, and he got destroyed in the process. So there may be an application here for that. I just never thought of this verse before.
Okay. And one quick thing, you said something earlier about our Holy Mother Mary being a virgin before, during, and after. Some Protestants would say, and us Catholics would probably disagree, but some Protestants would say that because if she did not give Joseph kids after Jesus, she would have been a bad woman, because historically the kids were a blessing then. Can you kind of respond on that?
Sure. Yeah. So this is one of those sort of misguided ways of kind of doing mental gymnastics on their part to try to avoid the truth that Mary did not have other children. Nothing about this marriage was typical. Nothing. So you have Mary, who is preserved free from all sin from the moment of her conception. You have God born to her. So God himself is their child. You know, they're the only people in the world who can say that. And it was fitting and proper that Mary be married and this be a family. Obviously, Jesus needed to be raised with a mother and a father who loved each other and who nurtured them, their own relationship, and nurtured him. So all of this shows the importance and the beauty of family life. But it wasn't necessary for Mary and Joseph to have a sexual relationship, nor was it necessary for them to have other children besides Jesus. What was necessary was that they formed the husband-wife, mother-father home for the boy Jesus to grow up in. So that argument is demanding or requiring something that is not, strictly speaking, necessary. Children are a blessing, that's true. But God, in some cases, chooses not to bless families with children, and that's his doing. In this case, his plan was that Mary and Joseph would live a virginal marriage with all the love and intensity and devotion that one could imagine, and probably far more than we could imagine, but without anything erotic or sexual. It was a completely chaste and pure virginal marriage, but it was not something weak and insipid. It was, you can try to imagine how much Mary and Joseph loved each other and how dutiful and careful St. Joseph was to guard Mary and Jesus. What a high honor he received. So I just, when people make those kinds of arguments, my sense of it is that they're straining at gnats, as the Bible says. They're trying as hard as they possibly can to disprove this teaching simply because the Catholic Church teaches it. If the Catholic Church didn't teach it, they wouldn't care about it. But because the Catholic Church teaches it, it's almost a reflexive, almost a Pavlovian reaction. Well, if the Catholic Church teaches it, it's got to be wrong. We've got to try to disprove that. I'll give you a quick example, Mike. I talked to a guy, I've talked to many people like him, but he was a former Baptist minister, and he became a Catholic, as many do. And I was talking to him one day over lunch, and he was telling me how weird it was when he was a Baptist minister, and there would be passages of scripture that he wanted to preach on from the different gospels, But he said he found out very quickly that if he preached on a passage of scripture that had anything to do with Mary at all, his congregation would get on his case because they didn't, you know, why are you talking about Catholic stuff? And he'd say, I'm not talking about Catholic stuff. I'm talking about what the Bible says. It's talking about Mary. And they just didn't like it. They had an aversion to it. Now, that may be localized to that community, but in my experience, it's more widespread than that. And it's indicative of what I'm referring to here is that they just have an allergic reaction to something that's Catholic or that they think is Catholic, and therefore they'll avoid it. So he said, I just avoided any passages that had anything to do with Mary. I just never preached on them because the congregation would get uptight. So anyway, I'll leave it at that, Mike. Thanks for the call. I appreciate that. Let's go to John now in Lyle. I hope I'm saying it, Illinois.
Yes, Lyle. Okay. Yes, Lyle, welcome, Illinois. John. Yes. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome.
There was some discussion today in the Rosary group, and somebody mentioned, when you're before Jesus and he asks you this, what will you say? And I thought, will he actually ask us questions, or will he give us the knowledge and say, and you'll know it. You'll know everything you did wrong and why it's wrong. And that's, I mean, it's not going to be a human conversation up and back. Is that, I wanted your take on that.
Yeah, interesting question. I don't know the answer to it, and we can speculate. Keep in mind, it will be a human conversation because you're human and Jesus mm-hmm. is a divine person with a human nature. So he's a man. So there's nothing precluding you from speaking directly to Jesus and vice versa. Now, obviously, human speech is limited, and it's a very crude way of communicating compared to, say, how the angels communicate by directly opening their minds to each other. But what form that will take, we don't know. It hasn't been revealed to us, at least not in Scripture. But whether or not he will ask you questions, it seems to me more likely, the way that you described it is probably more likely, and that would be that the Lord is going to show you. In other words, it'd be like standing in front of a mirror, and you will see with wonderful and hideous clarity the truth about yourself. You will see with wonderful and hideous clarity the truth about your actions in this life, all the sins and the good things as well. And St. Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 3, where he talks about the man who builds his temple rather on the foundation of Christ. And he talks about the works of his life, and some of it is bad. It's likened unto flammable material, wood, hay, and straw, he says. But he also talks about the gold, silver, and precious stones. So there are good, meritorious things in your life. All of these things will be shown to you, seems to me. And whether this takes place in the blink of an eye or if there's some extended time elapse, I don't know. I would suspect it would be very quick. You would have a sudden, an absolutely complete, crystal clear illumination in your mind of how you really are and what you really did, both good and evil. And then you will know, because then he will pronounce your judgment. It says in Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. So the judgment will be rendered and you will go up or down and you will know that this is the right place for you. You know, you will know if you're in the state of mortal sin that you have no place in heaven and you will burn your way down into hell and vice versa. If you know you're going to heaven, you're going to go to heaven. So it's a mysterious and awe-inspiring thing to think about, but the specific things, it's hard to know. We can only speculate. That's my take.
Right, right. One real quick follow-up on that is, so let's say we're going to heaven. Let's look at the good side. And will we still be aware of all the bad things we did that were forgiven in confession?
I think so.
Things like that?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think that this accounting, it's not like a scale where if you did enough good deeds that outweigh the bad deeds, then it tips the scale in your favor. It's not like that, because what decides your eternal destiny is the state of your soul when you die. Are you in the state of grace or in the state of mortal sin? But it seems to me, as Jesus said, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. Jesus said things like, you know, what has been done in secret will be shouted from the rooftops. What you've done in darkness will be brought out into the light. So at the very least, and I'm hoping that's not the case in the general judgment, at least not for those who are destined for heaven, but I do believe that in the particular judgment, every single last thing is going to be brought to light. Every single last thing. Jesus also says, I assure you that every idle word that you utter will be something you'll have to account for.
Mm, okay.
You know, so.
All right. Well, thank you.
Isn't that an incentive to.
A lot to look forward to. Yeah.
Indeed. Thank you, John. I certainly regard that as an incentive to virtue, don't you? When you think about it, everybody, and you realize that on the day that you're judged, you have your exit interview, every single thing is going to come out. And I mean everything. Think about that for a minute.
I don't want to hear this.
I know. Think about that. Every single thing, good and bad, it's all going to come out. And so for me, for my money, I wish I had known this earlier. Hello, McFly. I wish I could say that to myself years ago, but I mean, I certainly learned the lesson. I wish I had learned it earlier. But isn't that an incentive to virtue? I mean, if you know that every single last thing is going to come out in your exit interview, don't you want to have as few things as possible to have to deal with on the negative side? I sure do. And don't you want to have as many possible good things that the Lord will praise you for? Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. Now enter into the joy of your master. I mean, that's the word. Those are the words I want to hear. So think about that the next time you're tempted to do something or to cut corners or to, you know, try to get away with something. It's all going to come out in the end. Cyrus, you didn't do anything wrong.